Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Who can tell the truth about the blood-soaked battle for dominance among Mexico's drug cartels? Reuters reports more than 29,000 deaths in the country linked to the drug wars since President Felipe Calderon took office in late 2006, and drug gangs have murdered nearly 7,000 in the border city of Juarez alone since early 2008. But while foreign correspondents are still working overtime to bring these horrifying facts to light, Mexican journalists who dare to tell the story are increasingly becoming targets of the cartels. John Burnett covers the border for NPR. He's here now to talk about the state of the drug wars and about the agonizing choices they present to Mexican news organizations. John, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So how blatant are the messages from cartels to domestic journalists about what they are to cover and are not to cover?
It varies depending on the city that you're talking about. Mexico is a big country with 31 states and a lot of major metropolitan areas. Those that are in the areas of interest for the drug cartels, which would be mostly in the north, Monterrey,
Sinaloa,
Juarez, you know, all of the sort of the northern trade cities, those are the places the cartels care about. They want to massage the message. They want to control the message. Believe it or not, the cartels are fairly media savvy. One way they want to control the message is to dictate to newsrooms, your reporters may only come out after the police arrive on the crime scene. You should not have your reporters out after dark. You will not even mention the name of the Gulf Cartel in your columns, much less the names of Miguel Treviño or any of the Zeta commanders. And investigative reporting is suicidal. So in the extreme that I described to you, Mexican newspapers that are rather Mexican cities that are paralyzed by drug violence, their newspapers in some cases cannot even describe gunfights that are happening on Main Street in broad daylight because they're forbidden by the cartels to cover drug violence.
So are Mexican citizens looking to other publications to try and find out what's going on?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's where social media comes in, Chris. And YouTube and Twitter and Facebook have become sort of vital links for citizen journalists to try to convey to each other, this is what's going on. There is a shootout in the Plaza Central right now, and so don't go downtown. There is a checkpoint by either malicious policemen or narco traffickers on the edge of town. Don't go down there. So it's almost the way we've seen social media be used in places like Iran and China to have a kind of a subterranean news network that gets around the government censors.
Of course, these media savvy cartels are also using things like YouTube to put just horrifying things online.
Yeah. And in some cases, I think that it's interesting the sort of cross-pollination between what Al-Qaeda has done and what the Mexican cartels are increasingly doing. I don't know who started beheading, but now, we certainly see it by Islamic extremists as well as a lot of the drug cartels. And the thing about YouTube is that's where the cartels talk to each other. That's where they one-up each other. That's where they boast and they threaten each other. You can type into the search engine Zeta's Nuevo Laredo or Juarez Cartel, and a video will pop up, oftentimes a brutal one of someone being tortured, and then there'll be 12,000 comments because every few minutes someone's talking to each other about this. There are DEA agents that are assigned to follow these YouTube videos because they can reveal things about the cartels that they tell about themselves. They can also be misinformation because the cartels know law enforcement is watching. But in some ways, it's the way the CIA used to read, still does, foreign newspapers to sort of glean, information about a hostile government or something.
You mentioned beheading as a favorite tactic. And in fact, there was a really disturbing case this morning.
Aye, aye, aye. Yeah, it's awful. It just goes on and on. I mean, everybody's kind of fascinated by this crazy case down in Falcon Lake, between Zapata County and Tamaulipas, Mexico, where this guy David Hartley, a oil field service worker, and his wife Tiffany were jet skiing on Falcon Lake. What a bad idea that was. They were going over to see some church ruins, the old town of Guerrero that was flooded. And so Hartley was, according to his wife, killed by gunmen in motorboats. And she raced back across with her jet ski back to the U.S. side, the Texas side, to save her life. And so it became this, lurid story about, pirates on a Tex-Mex lake. And so the Mexican authorities are investigating this to see if they can find his body. And the chief state investigator, who's based in Miguel Alemán, on the Mexico side, he was looking into this. He was murdered. And then according to Siggy Gonzalez, who's the sheriff of Zapata County, his head was delivered in a suitcase to the front of a Mexican army base. And then Rick Perry was quoted in the AP this morning saying it was a warning to law enforcement to stay out of our territory. Obviously, traffickers don't want people snooping around. And this is a really hot area. That area of Falcon Lake is right in the middle of what's now a turf war that's being fought over between the Zetas and the Gulf Cartel. Really bloody war.
So one of the strategies that President Calderon has employed is to put thousands upon thousands of not just federales, but also Mexican army troops along the border and in these hot spots. But then there's the whole silver or lead question, and it's hard to know who's been bought out and who hasn't.
Yeah, plata o plomo, silver or lead. It's the old saying, do we buy you with silver or do we threaten you with a lead bullet? And there was a friend of mine who's an editor in Torreon, Mexico, and I saw him last week in Austin, and he said, yeah, John, it used to be plata o plomo. Now it's just plomo. Now it's just lead. They increasingly don't offer to buy you, to bribe you. They just threaten you. Don't cover this. Don't send your reporters here. And reporters in Mexico are kidnapped, tortured, beaten, threatened, and executed with absolute impunity because the cartels, if it's the cartels, it could be the government too, their assailants know that they will not be prosecuted. They won't be caught or prosecuted. So there is a chill. There's a fear among Mexican journalists that I've never witnessed before.
So the most recent journalist killed was a 21-year-old photographer shooting for El Diario de Juarez. Mm-hmm. And first of all, what do we know about why he might have been targeted?
Well, this has been the latest horrifying killing of a journalist. It was Luis Carlos Santiago, who was a young photographer for El Diario de Juarez, the main daily in Juarez, which is the most murderous city in the country. And we don't know why he was killed. I mean, he didn't have a long enough record. He wasn't a particularly daring photographer. He was brand new at the paper. He'd just gone from an intern to full time. It's not like he was there was a crime journalist who was killed at Diario de Juarez back in November of 2008, and he actually had been writing about cartel crime, and so we sort of understood why he would have been targeted. He was killed in his vehicle with his daughter next to him. All of the maddening interpretations. Well, why did this happen? What do we make of this? And that's why the newspaper is so frightened. It's like, well, what is the message you're trying to send to us? What did we do wrong? This kid was just starting to take pictures. He was a very sort of mainstream photographer who traveled with the pack of the sort of, the paparazzi of death in Juarez, at crime scenes. And that's this extraordinary editorial that the Diario wrote, which went all around Mexico and was reported on internationally. It, really incredible. The Sunday after he was killed, on the front page of the paper, it said, "What do you want of us?" And then the op-ed inside went on to say, "You," meaning the cartels, "are the de facto authorities in town. The actual authorities have lost power in our city, and so what do we have to do or not do or say in our newspaper so that you'll stop killing our colleagues?" it was just an amazingly frank, kind of desperate editorial that was reprinted all over Mexico, and it became a kind of a phenomenon because finally an editor had had the guts to say, you, the drug mafias, are the de facto authorities in this city, which could be said of an increasing number of cities in Mexico.
That editorial was interpreted in a lot of different ways. Some people said that Diario was saying, we'll do whatever you want, stop hurting us. And you don't really read it that way.
Yeah, there were, one interpretation was they were surrendering. They were saying, you know, censor us, you know, mm-hmm. tell us what not to, which of course, you know, is forbidden in the world of journalism. And yet I don't think it was that so much as they wanted to publicize the plight of journalists. It's like, well, everybody seemed to get upset that we were with this plea of ours, and yet, you know, people have in Mexico have been allowing the slaughter of and the threatening of journalists without really, you know, demanding any sort of consequences for it. And they're still covering crime at Diario. I know some of the reporters there, and they're absolutely still covering crime. Although I think that space has now narrowed even more that they can operate in.
And, you know, we talk about their courage, not that anybody is doing this for money. And, you know, journalists the world over are not known for being wealthy people. But in Mexico, this is a really modestly compensated profession.
Yeah. And you know, to be honest, that's one side is courage and the other side is corruption. And certainly some of the journalists who've been killed in Mexico were taking money from the wrong cartel, unquestionably. In a city like... Well, in a city where a drug cartel dominates, obviously, if you're a crime reporter, there's going to be some sort of arrangement. You would not be allowed to do your job without these criminal authorities sort of allowing you or sort of telling you, here's what we'll allow, and maybe even, you know, paying you off. And so a new cartel comes to town, and so you start that the new cartel starts to whack some of the associates of the existing cartel, and journalists can be included in that if you're taking Chayo, you know, payoffs from the wrong criminals.
Payoffs have sort of been part of the understanding of how Mexico works for a long time. Maybe not to this degree of corruption and maybe not entirely controlled by cartels. But can you talk about what makes it different now? What in particular makes the drug wars so much fiercer in the past 3 years or so than they've been before?
Gosh, that's a complicated question, Chris. I don't think you can understand the level of violence and the spread of drug violence in Mexico right now and how expansive it's gotten, really taking over whole states in some cases, unless you understand that corruption is systemic. It's absolutely endemic in government from the city hall and the police department through state governments to the very federal agents and federal soldiers. They're sending like the cavalry to go rescue a city from the drug cartels. And in many cases, you know, these some individual soldiers and commanders are taking part in some of the same crimes that they're supposed to be saving the citizens from. And so President Felipe Calderón, I believe, and many believe, is sincere in his will to confront the drug cartels. But he is presented with a government that, as soon as he dispatches people into these areas where there's, you know, the payoffs are so vast, the possibility, that he loses control of them. And so you end up with his own drug czar, Noe Fernandez, back in 2008, was arrested for taking payoffs from the Beltran Leyva cartel. I mean, you know, imagine if that happened to, you know, Obama's drug czar.
My guest is John Burnett. He covers the border for NPR. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Burnett, who covers the border for NPR. He's based in Austin. So President Calderon was in Juarez yesterday, surveying what was going on and sort of talking about the placement of troops along the border. How big of a threat is the current situation to his political authority? You've already mentioned the fact that he doesn't have the power to change things by himself. Does he have any authority at all anymore?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, he's still the commander-in-chief of a very large military. And he can change the strategy and the tactics of his cartel war, you know, anytime he wants to. You know, you always have the threat of his people, you know, being corrupted. But there are parts of Mexico in which they are taking on the cartels in frontal battles, and particularly in Tamaulipas, which is, you know, south of South Texas, of, you know, McAllen and Brownsville. The Mexican Navy and the Mexican Army take on the Zetas and the Gulf Cartel, and it's they're you know, they're full fledged firefights.
Well, let me interrupt you, because there have been some allegations that some cartels are taken on very aggressively and others are sort of allowed to continue operating. Do you see evidence of that?
Well, you're talking to one of the reporters that that reported
that
story.
I'm feeding you a question here.
Yeah, NPR has done some very aggressive reporting on the story in Mexico that the government somehow goes easy on the Sinaloa cartel, which is the oldest, most established and richest and in some ways most sophisticated drug cartel. And we continue to believe that elements of the Sinaloa cartel, which are, of course, in the Pacific coastal state of Sinaloa, bribe higher, bribe more, bribe more important federal authorities than any other cartel does. They all bribe people. But some of them sort of do it more on a local and a state level. But the Sinaloans are geniuses at finding important people in the security secretariat and in the army and putting them on the payroll. That doesn't mean Calderon is favoring the Sinaloans. Mm-hmm. That's a blanket statement that, you know, that you can't back up. But certainly elements of the federal government have seemed to have more relationships with the Sinaloans than other cartels.
Would things be more stable if Sinaloa or another cartel were allowed to be absolutely dominant and there were no competition?
You know, that's an interesting question. There's a lot of...
It's like a deal with the devil.
That's right. There's a lot of sort of parlor talk in Mexico about that, you know, that somehow that's the way it used to be. And the Sinaloa cartel used to be dominant. And then the Juarez cartel was. And is somehow the government's game to try to eliminate all the other cartels and leave one that it can control and have arrangements with. And it's all speculation. I think it's sort of unlikely, actually, because you know, you can't turn the clock back, and the Zeta cartel, which is probably the most dangerous now, because it's involved in all sorts of criminality, not just drug smuggling. You know, they're not going to be eliminated lightly. I mean, they're really fighting back, and I don't think you could, you know, expect to completely defeat them.
What about this? In this country, our strategy in fighting organized crime has been to sort of go after the capo and hope that everybody else will fall or be really disorganized and disintegrate after that. Would that work in Mexico?
I'm sorry, say that again?
To go after the head of an organization.
Oh. Well, they've done that, and actually Calderon has been successful in arresting some of the capos, and most recently is Labarbe, Valdez Virial, who was this sort of the butcher of Nuevo Laredo back in 2005. And there has a certain symbolic effect that we're making progress, and the DEA trumpets it in this country, particularly when they're extradited. But the practical effect in Mexico is it fragments organized crime even more. So there's an old saying that, you know, you cut off the brains and the thugs take over. There is an interpretation of all this that some of the old capos kind of knew how to run things, and they weren't into this ultra violence, this almost theatrical violence that the cartels are into now. You know, cutting their enemies' heads off and, you know, rolling them into disco floors and things. And so, you know, when you take all those guys out, you end up with this absolute free-for-all where there are no more rules and no more understandings. There's no more agreed-on turf. You know, officials are not safely bought anymore. Everything is at play, which is the situation. You can't expect a government to stop, you know, wanting to keep arresting the top guys. I mean, they're going to do that. But it's that's been one of the most discouraging features of Calderon's drug war, that the more capos he arrests, it seems like the more violence there is.
Let's speak first to Gustavo in Dallas. Hi, Gustavo.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I actually hail from Juarez, and I must congratulate NPR on the eve of Felipe Calderon's visit, the most recent visit to the United States. It was actually NPR that brought forth the story that said that the so-called war on organized crime in Mexico was not an even-handed war, that it tended to favor the powerful Sinaloa cartel. And, yeah, I would slightly disagree with your guest in that it is not as easy or not as clear to make the connection all the way up to Calderon and the leader of the Sinaloa cartel in that, you know, this was a man who was imprisoned under the previous Fox administration of the same party as Calderon and surprisingly and mysteriously escaped from prison. And during the Fox administration, and it is widely believed, and certainly, in fact, in my hometown of Juarez, that one of the reasons, and Juarez is paying the price, that the powers that be in the federal government, and including the Felipe Calderon, backed the Sinaloa cartel, whereas in Chihuahua, the officials in Ciudad Juarez and in the state of Chihuahua were backing the Juarez cartel, and what we see on the streets is basically this high level. Struggle of power of who controls the drug trade in Mexico.
Thanks for your call, Gustavo. You want to respond to that?
What do you have a question?
Did you want to ask a question with that, or you just wanted to make the statement, Gustavo?
It's unfortunate, and I would just say that my question is, what do you think needs to change in Mexico so that we, you know, here in the United States, see some concrete results in terms of a lessening of violence in the country?
Yeah, that's a great comment. Thanks for all that, Gustavo. I mean, personally, it seems to me that when you just take on the capos and you attack the structures of organized crime, you're only getting at sort of the top of the pyramid. And that if you're truly serious about undermining the structure of organized crime in Mexico, which is extensive, you have to get into the bank accounts of politicians who are paid with drug money. You have to get into all of the businesses that are created by laundered drug money and that surround the legitimate businesses that surround the criminals. And you have to, you know, expose those and show that we're going to go after the complete criminal structure, not just the guys with guns. And there's really been no willingness to do that in Mexico.
How blatantly are these organizations recruiting new members?
Well, they come to them. They don't, you know, they do some recruiting, but this is a fairly attractive job for, you know, young, rootless, adventurous Mexican men, and their numbers are expanding exponentially, Chris. It's really, that's one of the disturbing things about it. NAFTA hasn't panned out as everyone had hoped, and in northern Mexico, in the areas where you have all of the assembly plants, and, you know, of course, along the border is one of the industrial engines of Mexico. That's a prosperous area relative to the rest of the country, and yet this is where the cartels are most successful in recruiting young men.
Because it's $10 or $20 a day in a maquila, right?
That's right.
To unlimited income potential.
Yeah, versus, you know, $1,000 a week or much more. And so there seems to be kind of a limitless supply of young men willing to do this. There's a certain romanticism that's also attached to this, and a kind of a cultural romanticism to drug trafficking. I mean, there's always been corridos, ballads about drug traffickers in Mexico, going back to, the revolution. But now there are even more. I mean, there are whole bands that dedicate themselves to writing drug ballads and sort of romanticizing the exploits of all these gangsters. And then the YouTubes we talked about, which also tends to amplify their exploits online. So, there's this element to it also.
Well, your piece this weekend was really interesting on the narcocorridos, because it used to be that Mexican radio stations would broadcast to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And be able to do whatever they wanted. Now it's the opposite.
Yeah, actually, the narcocorridos, the Mexican government has banned them from the airwaves because they celebrated the exploits of organized crime. Some of them are still broadcast, but now what's happened is in South Texas, there are radio stations that have corrido hours, and they broadcast narco corridos, which is a little bit risky. I mean, there was a guy, Valentin Elizalde, who was a narco corrido singer, and he was killed in Reynosa after singing a narco corrido that offended the Gulf Cartel. Then the song on the jukebox can get you killed.
What do you hear, John, from regular, honest Mexican citizens who just want to feed their kids and go to work every day and go to church on Sundays, and in some parts of the country now are really afraid to leave the house unless they absolutely have to?
It's so distressing. It's hard for us to imagine it here in our cities in Texas. But, I mean, all they want to do is raise their children and enjoy their lives and go out on the weekends and just sort of give me my normal life. And yet, because of the collapse of the rule of law in certain cities in Mexico, you can't let your daughter walk on the street without worrying about someone kidnapping her because they may take a fancy to her, or worse, the taqueria on the corner all the way to the large established restaurant, they're all having to pay extortion to these organized crime rackets, to even do business. It's as though, it's Chicago in the 20s, throughout northern Mexico. And there appears to be no end in sight. That's the depressing thing about it.
Next on the line, we have Terry in Dallas. Hi, Terry.
Hello. I just want to point out that this world is going into lunacy because of what I consider the permissiveness of governments. If we continue to have civil rights, human rights, and all the permissiveness of crime, we're going to continue this, and this is going to be what they call a black planet. I don't see any hope unless this government turns out people like, if you have to say, I'm 80 years old, so I remember a guy named Hoover who took no prisoners. And I'm not saying that he could really change things, but at least he'd make a fight and put these people in public squares, hang them, and even torture them. Because I believe that without that kind of activity, that the extreme activity, an eye for an eye, that nothing will get done and the politicians will continue. And that's all there is to it. And incidentally, the prison sentences for politicians is absolutely, I wouldn't say null and void, but it's very limited. It's like murder. You have to give somebody life sentence or kill them.
I assume you're talking about Mexico needs to get tough.
Well, look, it could happen in the United States as well.
I disagree.
Well, let's talk about that, because there is this extraordinary level of violence south of the border. So
yeah.
Far, in a lot of the U.S. border cities, the crime rates have not been – they have not reflected the amount of violence that has surged.
No, they haven't. And there's an awful lot of buzz about the threat of spillover violence. And some of this is real. There is a fear among border residents, and I'm not going to question whether people who live in Fort Hancock or Brownsville are afraid of the bullets that occasionally fly across and of the wounded Mexican victims who make their way across the bridge and to the hospital, but that somehow this drug violence, that the stuff that we see in the streets of Juarez is going to move to the streets of El Paso, it just hasn't happened, and it's not predicted to happen. The DEA doesn't think it's going to happen.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, we, you know, contrary to what the last caller said, there is a rule of law here. And the narcos know this, and they know that they have utter impunity in the streets of their cities because they own the police and they won't be arrested. They don't own the police in this country, and they will be arrested. And if they do time, they'll do hard time for the rest of their lives in federal prisons. And they can't buy their way out of prison like Chapo Guzman did in 2001 out of a La Palma Mexican prison. And so they don't want to get caught over here. That doesn't mean they're not over here partying and recreating. I think there are lots of narcos who come to Texas border communities to, you know, fight cocks and go to horse races and have, you know, property over here and girlfriends over here. I think that happens to an extent that we don't realize.
Are they setting up housekeeping?
Well, you know, they want a place to go relax. And, you know, I mean, they're all in the crosshairs. And so, you know, the U.S. Provides that. But if they start committing crimes over here, then, you know, they're going to sort of, you know, soil their nest. So
what about the $1.5 billion the U.S. is spending trying to help with this? Where's that money going?
That's the Merit Initiative. It's been over 3 years, about $1.5 billion. That's the Mexico's the biggest recipient of security aid in of all the Americas now. It's gone to Calderon's drug war, and a lot of it has gone to sort of fortifying the judiciary down there for making better investigation of crimes, better prosecution. Some of it's gone to X-ray machines. Some of it has gone to helicopters that go to the federal police as well as the Army. The same groups that have been denounced for human rights abuses against their own citizens in this drug war. And so actually it surprises me that the aid is not more controversial. This has been the policy in the Bush administration, and Obama continued it, that we are going to support Calderon's drug war, although I think it's becoming more and more apparent that it's not working.
John Burnett is with us. He covers the border for NPR. We'll resume our conversation in a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Burnett. He covers the border for NPR, along with Jason Bobian, who is stationed in Mexico City. Go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Anne in Arlington. Hello, Anne.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon. I'm enjoying the show a lot, as I always do. I have a comment and a question for Mr. Burnett. The first, if he cares to comment on the comment, that would be great. You spoke about the amazing amount of money that the U.S. has put into Mexico for Calderon in fighting the drug war. My question is, this money often seems to be given there and other places in some kind of a very amorphous fashion, and it seems that it lacks any kind of traceability or accountability, leaving open the question of in the wrong hands, can this be just sort of additional slush funds to strengthen the people that are already bought? And the question part of it is, I've heard the situation characterized as the U.S. being effectively a very large nose sitting atop Mexico inhaling.
Can you respond to that?
Sure, I'm happy to. Thanks, Ann. You know, I track this stuff, and I haven't seen a lot of kind of vague accounting yet, as you said, amorphous accounting. I mean, I have printouts on my desk in Austin of, you know, pages and pages of very specific places where the money goes for training and for dogs and drug sniffing dogs and X-ray machines and you know, six Black Hawk helicopters. So I don't know about that. Maybe there will be a scandal to be revealed. We will wait and see. In terms of the that great sucking sound on the U.S. side, the great nose inhaling huge quantities of Mexican cocaine, that's such an important point. There's an old saying that poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States, it was never truer than with the its proximity to the U.S. drug market, which is the largest market for illegal drugs in the world. So we are the silent partners in this mayhem that is going on in Mexico, because we're the market that they are servicing, that they're fighting each other to service. There's also a lot of organized crime going on in Mexican cities against Mexicans. But still, it's mainly about drugs, and it's about drugs for Americans. And it's really important that people realize that anytime cocaine is bought by a recreational drug user up here, or Mexican meth, or Mexican club drug, or Mexican weed, that recreational users here are contributing directly to this savage situation in Mexico.
Let's talk about that a little more, because nobody is talking about legalizing cocaine. But a lot of people these days are saying if we would just legalize marijuana, we would sort of kick out one leg of the tripod and maybe this whole thing would collapse. Are these guys who are making all this money on illegal drugs, would they give it up if somehow they lost their marijuana revenue?
That's a great question. There's a lot of buzz about that now. In California, especially, where it's on the ballot, this initiative about whether they should legalize drugs, legalize marijuana. And there was a report that was announced yesterday by the RAND Corporation, which is a big think tank in California. And they study this very question. If marijuana is legalized in California, would it have an effect on undermining one of the profit centers for the cartels? They decided that it would not. And one reason, interestingly, is because the Mexican mafia can still grow marijuana and export it so cheaply, and marijuana has become so boutique and expensive and hydroponically grown and everything in this country that they could still maintain the black market of cheap pot to U.S. users. There would still be a market for cheap Mexican marijuana even if it was legalized. Now, that's one argument. The other one is, which I hear in Mexico from journalists and others whose opinions I value, is why would you think that these Mexican organized crime figures would get tired of breaking the law and decide to go straight just because they lost the income from marijuana? In 1933, when Prohibition was repealed and we had all of these mafias up in Chicago and other places that were bringing in smuggled liquor, what did they do? I mean, they didn't all suddenly, you know, go join the church choir. I mean, these mafias got into labor racketeering and narcotics and gambling and other criminal activities. And the mafias in Mexico have already shown that they're interested in any way possible to make money. I mean, former drug smuggling organizations like the Zetas are now getting into, you know, pirated DVD sales, after-hours liquor sales in Monterey, alien smuggling. I mean, just every way they can squeeze a criminal dollar out of the cities, you know, they're going after that. So why would we think that losing the marijuana market is going to make them go straight? This could be completely wrong logic. We don't really know. But I know that there are many skeptics in Mexico.
Let's go next to Sharon in Dallas. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, and thanks for taking my question. Mm-hmm. I grew up in El Paso, and Juarez was part of the social fabric. Dinner, dancing, drinking, you know, we did everything if we wanted to. And now I live in Dallas, and when I call home or I talk to my family, there seems to be this disconnect. I hear the horrible things that are going on the border, and I watch the news, and it scares me and it saddens me, but people in El Paso don't seem to think it's that bad. Can you explain the disconnect?
I spend a lot of time in El Paso and Juarez, too, because it's kind of a hotspot for reporting. I mean, I think part of it is the spin about this potential for spillover violence, and I think it's pumped up by opportunistic politicians who want to get more funding for their own departments on the border, or who want to bash the president's border security. And so as a journalist, I check stuff out. And so there's all these bogus reports. You know, the Zetas have taken over a ranch outside of Laredo, which was starting to be reported. I mean, some of this stuff it's just not true. And I think there's a kind of hysteria in the reporting about the border that you got to be really careful about, that people, you know, outside of the border may, really believe. But, you know, it works both ways, Sharon. I mean, I think people are pretty relaxed in El Paso, but there are other cities like Fort Hancock, for instance, some other areas where they really are frightened that things are going to come across at any minute. But the point is, the violence that we've seen in Mexico, to a great extent, has not crossed the border yet.
John, do you take a different kind of precaution? Do you take different kinds of precautions than you did, say, 5 years ago?
Well, you mean when I go into Mexico to report?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I try to take rented cars. It's not my own vehicle. I know that it's going to be hard to get frank interviews because people are really scared now. You can see this mask of fear. And you can't trust who you're talking to. You don't know whether the taxi driver, you know, even the journalist who works in a newsroom that, you know, that you sort of trust, that they're on the payroll of the cartels. You got to be careful about your sources. And I'm not so much worried as about the common crime in the cities has gotten worse. And so, you know, if you look like you've got something, I don't carry my laptop across the street in Mexico anymore in these towns. Because it could be snatched so easily. Because again, there's just been this kind of proliferation of crime. Because nobody's arresting the criminals.
What does it take for Mexican journalists to get asylum in the United States?
A lot of luck. There's only one that's done it so far in El Paso. There's also a journalist who just got asylum in Canada. There are three that are applying. They have to show this well-founded fear of persecution, that it's a thought crime, that the thing that they're saying is part of a, in this case, an individual whose speech is going to get them killed. And, you know, there may be indications that immigration judges are more sympathetic to that argument than in the past, but it's still a really tough sell.
Is it a greater challenge if you're being threatened by a criminal organization as opposed to by your government specifically and explicitly?
Yeah, typically it's been people from North Korea and from, you know, Cuba and Iran and places and China who tend to get asylum because the classic dissident who speaks out against his government and then he's arrested. And this is a very much a different twist on it. This is these are economic mafias. Although in Mexico, some of the testimony we hear from journalists fleeing are that they were threatened by the army. They were threatened by the Chihuahuan state government. So by no means is it just the cartels.
Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hey, John.
Yes, I've been following this issue for about 25 years. Since the mother of my girlfriend refused, this was in the 80s, to go across the border from El Paso to Juarez because, quote, things are different, even starting back then. But a question that I have is, what would happen if the Party of Institutional Corruption, or the PRI, takes over from the PAN? We've already seen a tremendous number of police that have been corrupted into the gangs, the judicial police, for example. What does he think would happen if the PRI took over and really institutionalized the drug trade?
Yeah, that's a big speculative question. And as the elections are, you know, a couple of years away in Mexico, 2 years away, will the PRI regain the presidency? They've been out of power for 10 years now. Will it be a different party that doesn't have the some of the links to organized crime that were talked about in the past? That's a really important question, and I'm not going to speculate as to what would happen. We know that the world has changed in Mexico, and that it's all changed. The governorships are not controlled by the PRI anymore. The mayors aren't. Their whole sort of pyramid has blown apart. They don't control the journalists anymore. They don't control the labor unions as much. Everything has changed, and so I don't know that you could expect things to go back the way they were.
Given the level of corruption, do Mexican voters have any confidence in their ability to affect change or to choose the right person to fix what's wrong with the country?
Well, they're pretty cynical about their politicians, but they keep going to the polls, and hope springs eternal, I suppose. But it's a very, very cynical voting public in Mexico.
How much has the international global economic downturn played into this, if at all?
Well, it's definitely hurt some of Mexico's industries, and it's hurt some of the remittances that Mexicans in this country send home. That's dropped quite a bit. That has squeezed Mexico's economy so that I suppose young men who are looking for work may be more receptive to working for the cartels. Easy money, they think.
What about sort of base level law enforcement officers working for the U.S. government, Border Patrol guys and women, we should say? What do they think ought to change that's not being done? Have they expressed that to you?
Gosh. They haven't.
Are they as afraid of what's happening to Mexico as people who are right along the border that are civilians?
No. I mean, these are federal agents. I mean, they're well-trained, and they have big guns, and they have an awful lot of backup, more all the time. Pilotless drones and helicopters and airboats and four-wheelers and, there's a militarization going on along the border, whether, you hear about it from politicians in the interior of the United States is a different matter. But if you spend time on the border, that it's been building up for more and more. And I think that, they're along with the wall, the physical barrier, it's harder to cross all the time. And that's one theory as to why the drug violence has also gotten so brutal, is because it is more difficult to move the product across, and so it's kind of bottled up, some of the drugs inside Mexico.
John Burnett covers the border for NPR, as does Jason Beaubien, who is based in Mexico City. Thank you so much for making time to be with us today.
Thanks for your interest, Chris. It's really been a treat to be here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.